Welcome to Friday and welcome to the Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW. We've got the Week in Review panel this week, managing editor of Northwest News Network. I'm not going to be able to say that again soon, Phyllis Fletcher.
Okay.
She's about to be NPR's newest bureau chief. Congratulations.
Thank you.
We'll talk more about that. Nikita Oliver, attorney, activist, poet, former Seattle mayoral candidate. Hi, Nikita.
What's up? So excited to be here.
Happy you're here. And we have someone who's done the job, a former two-term mayor of Seattle and former King County councilman, currently grandpa, and Week in Review panelist. Good to see you again, Greg.
Good to be here.
Greg Nichols is with us, and we're glad you're here. What a week for Seattle with the mayor of the city resigning. Of course, a family member of Ed Murray, Murray's cousin's son, claimed that Murray sexually abused him in the 1970s. Murray has denied this, but said he didn't want his personal problems to distract the city, and he resigned on Wednesday. Greg Nichols, former mayor, after the first four allegations, you were saying that Murray should stay in office. Did you feel differently after this allegation?
I did. I think that Ed made the right decision. Seattle can move forward. We have our first interim mayor in 48 years right now. Perhaps later tonight we'll have our second interim mayor.
That's right. There's a question over whether the council president wants to give up his seat.
When the other mayors and I made our statement, we weren't talking about whether or not Ed Murray had done these things. What we were talking about is the idea that having a planned transition is better for the city than having a series of unplanned and on-the-fly transitions. But I think with the revelations earlier this week,
what was different about this week's revelations?
Well, I think the cumulative aspect of it, the fact that it was someone who wasn't here but in another place at another time.
This was in New York when Murray was living with this other part of his family.
Yeah, so I think he made the right decision.
Nikita Oliver, you were calling for Murray's resignation earlier. What did you make of this week and what changed?
Yeah, you know, I actually think it's incredibly problematic that people are now saying the process worked and, you know, the accumulation of accusations is what to actually moved him out of office. You know, for us, for me, especially when the CPS report came out, that is an administrative law finding that basically says not only were there allegations of sexual abuse that were found to actually have existed, but in the state of Oregon, Murray's not allowed to have foster care children, which means an administrative body found him unfit based on these allegations of sexual abuse. And so,
but a prosecutor did not take it to a criminal charge.
And that prosecutor also said part of the reason we didn't do that is because the victim was not in a place to be able to testify, was a runaway at that time. And a lot of these young people are foster care youth who have been through immense amounts of trauma, and there's reasons why they would be runaways or dealing with addiction. And so I think we should have been calling for Murray to resign a long time ago, not just because it disrupts the business of the city, but because it is problematic that a white wealthy politician would be able to have four allegations of sexual abuse lodged against them, and there's no uproar about it. If that had been anyone else, especially a person of color, it would have been a totally different situation.
You think Seattle has a mayor of color and that mayor has to resign right away, whereas Murray didn't? What does race and wealth have to do with it in this case?
I think you can see even just around, let's take myself for example, just the comments that I make about policy are enough to cause uproars in the city, and that has to do with race and wealth. We look at football players. Let's talk about Michael Vick, who, you know, everybody's up in arms that he was having dogs fight each other, and that's something that he's not able to get over. That's going to mark his career for the rest of his life. But here you have a white wealthy politician who has four allegations of sexual abuse, one including an administrative law finding, and we still allow him to stay in office without really much uproar about it because we're worried it'll disrupt the business of the city. What about the disruption of victims and people who have suffered sexual abuse, and the fact that there is a history of allowing white men with money to get over when it comes to sexual abuse allegations.
Phyllis Fletcher?
Yeah, I think also it could have been completely different depending on who the initial accusers,
absolutely,
initial public accusers had been. These guys had been poor, had had trouble with the law, were Black and biracial, and their credibility was the first thing to be attacked mm-hmm. in this entire process. And only when it was a relative of the mayor's did that change things for some people.
Greg Nichols, is it fair to be bringing race and class into this?
Well, I think we have a bunch of issues here, and I would say that it's a little unfair to say there was no uproar. If you had asked me on April 1st what the politics of this year would bring, I would have said Ed Murray would be elected in a landslide. Mm-hmm. April 6th, the first allegations came out, and within a couple of weeks, he was no longer a candidate for re-election. So there was an uproar. It didn't lead immediately to his resignation, but I do think there was an uproar. And I think that we need to look at what happens to victims in situations like that when they are accusing a powerful person. It is a very tough situation to be in. Victims often don't come forward for a very long time, and there are reasons for that. And we need to ask, you know, why Oregon didn't move forward. Why in 2008 didn't the Seattle Times print what they had, what they knew? And look at ourselves in the mirror as well. But I think there was an uproar, and I think it this week led to its inevitable conclusion.
Yeah, Nikita, we're going to look ahead, and the Ed Murray specific case will be behind us. But do you have any concern that in the future you're kind of asking Seattle voters to rush to judgment in a case where there's an allegation, but the person accused says this is completely untrue?
I don't think I've asked Seattle voters to rush to judgment. I mean, reality is Murray has been completely unaccountable and has actually victim blamed. And when the allegations first came out, I said we should allow due process to do its course. That's what, as a lawyer, that's what I have agreed ethically to support. But once you have an administrative law finding from Child Protective Services in the state of Oregon that says that these allegations have been substantiated regardless of whether or not they've gone through a criminal court process, at that point, Murray should have stepped down. He should have resigned. Instead, if you in one of the Seattle Times articles, he says if he had known that that finding existed, he would have appealed it instead of at least taking some amount of accountability and being even bothered by the fact that an administrative law body found him unfit to be a foster care parent. At no point has he shown any amount of remorse. And so I don't think that's jumping to conclusions. I think that's an administrative law finding that should have had effect, and more politicians in this city should have called for his resignation. I got to give Lorena Gonzalez props because she definitely stepped out and took a chance there. But it took way too long for people to say leadership in our city has to be held to a higher standard. And that standard in this instance is not being met.
And also recognize that declining to use your own judgment to say, should this person be in office or not? That's not a violation of due process. You know, a violation of due process would be throw them in jail, throw them under right. the jail. A decision to abdicate your own judgment is a decision to do that.
Okay. First of all, Ed Murray has denied all of these allegations, including the latest one. He's denied paying for sex. He's denied having sex with minors. Categorical denial of all of this. And this week, Murray's sister, regarding the latest accusation, Murray's sister, Aileen Policros, is backing him up. She told King 5 that she doesn't believe this cousin's claim.
If anything had happened to that kid, if anybody had touched a hair on his head, he would have gone screaming from the bedroom to his mother. Because he was a bully, and you know bullies can't take bullying or anything else happening to them. I know that guy. I know him. And he's a sicko.
His mother's even sicker. So she's agreeing with Murray that this is part of an old family feud. Do you think that is even worth considering? What do you think of that? His sister coming out, and because she's been silent since these allegations began.
That's a terrible way to talk about a child. I know this is someone who's grown now, but to assign motive and what someone would have or could have done if they had been not had sex with, abused, okay? Because I really would be surprised to find out that 13 was a consensual age to engage in that. But that's that to me undermines that person's credibility in that statement, not the child's.
Let's talk about Ed Murray, the person, because I want to play one more thing that his sister said. She said she talked to Ed Murray this week and that he's doing horribly and his life is over.
His 30 years, his body of work is gone. Everything he did is gone. His savings is gone, he and his husband. Their savings is gone, their retirement's gone, and in Washington State, in a civil case, they can take the house.
In a civil case, they can take his house. So she's painting a picture, her words, of sort of a broken man. And I want to ask you, is there anything, again, Ed Murray denies all of this, but is there anything Murray could do to redeem himself?
I don't think this is about redemption. This is about accountability. We're talking about someone who has failed to have any remorse or express any concern for any victim anywhere, let alone the ones who have brought allegations against him. Not even the one for whom, like I said, there are administrative law findings that those allegations are true and they're real. And so, you know, I believe in restorative justice. Part of restorative justice requires accountability. So the same things that we ask people within restorative justice circles to do, which is account for harm, I have not heard Murray account for any amount of harm. And what she describes, the loss of a home or the loss of a job, are really collateral consequences that would be much worse had he been through a criminal sanctioning process. And so, also, these are the realities of being highly visible, but also, why are we treating public service like it's anything more than a privilege? It is a privileged opportunity to get voted into office and to serve people and serve their interests, including the victims of sexual abuse. And so Murray needs to be accountable. This is not right now about redemption. We're actually still at the accounting stage.
Murray's sister says their father was an alcoholic who, quote, beat the crap out of the Murray brothers. If Ed Murray were to admit to this, which he hasn't, and if he apologized and dedicated his next act in life to the issue of sexual abuse of young people, speaking tours and fundraising, would that be a case of restorative justice to you? Could you embrace Ed Murray in the future?
I think Ed Murray has every right to be restored back to society. I personally would not allow Ed Murray to be around my own children or other vulnerable populations, which is the same way we treat other folks who we believe have committed sex offenses, as a way of making sure we protect both them and young people from that happening again. And again, restorative justice does not mean that you return exactly back to the exact place you were in. It means that we move through a process of accounting, and then we have to rebuild appropriate boundaries to ensure that everyone, including Murray, are safe in whatever relationships they're able to therein develop with those accountable relationships. And so to even talk like that is really a benefit and a privilege of being white and wealthy. He still has not accounted, and yet we've already moved on to redemption. I think it's really important that we ask ourselves, what does accountability look like in this instance? Him being removed from the mayorship is not accountability. It's actually removing the privilege of being our leader, and now he needs to move into the process of accountability.
Anyone have more to say about the future of Ed Murray?
I would just say I think that that the way this has unfolded over the last 30 years, he hasn't had his day in court and the victims haven't had their day in court. And I think that that needs to happen. And then I think you could talk about redemption and how to make up for what's happened.
Let's talk about the future of the city of Seattle then. You, Greg Nichols, you and three other mayors had signed this open letter back earlier saying that it would be too disruptive to the city for there to be a quick and, chaotic change.
Yeah.
This week, the transition happened as it did with we have a temporary mayor, et cetera. Is there anything about it that seems chaotic or disruptive far?
I think this has been a very chaotic week in inside City Hall and for the people of Seattle.
In a way that hurts the city? And tell us about that.
You know, The way that the charter has the succession, we will have a city council member, whether it's Bruce Harrell as the council president or another member because he decides, I guess, later today not to take on the interim role. We will have someone who has knowledge of the city. So that's good. They will not have been an executive in a political structure like the city. So it's very likely, I think, they'll be a caretaker. And then it shortens the transition for the new mayor. The new mayor will be elected in early November, and the day that the election is certified, which is November 28th, they will take the oath of office. And so their ability to put their administration together will be very much truncated. So I think we will feel that it's a difficult job. Nobody has done it before of the folks that we're talking about. And so there's a learning curve. Yeah. And we've seen that learning curve take longer or shorter, depending on how much experience and luck the person has. But it is a learning curve. Mistakes get made, and more are likely to take place with that shorter transition period. I think that both candidates should be thinking about that transition now, perhaps putting quietly together groups to help them make that couple of week transition as effective as possible. I think we shouldn't criticize them if they do that, because it will make sure that whichever one is victorious has a better chance of being successful from the get-go.
Speaking of Carrie Moon and Jenny Durkin, the two candidates who are running in November and one would take over in January, we're going to talk more about, they had a debate this week, we're going to talk more about the mayor's race in a moment. Before we leave Ed Murray, I just want to get, this kind of reflects on the two candidates because Carrie Moon, Durkin is saying that Murray's doing the right thing by resigning, but Carrie Moon has been telling Murray to resign since May, and she said it's too late for Durkin to be holding Murray accountable.
I came out early asking him to step down. She has only done so today, and I think when the pressure got too high, I think she could have stood up for victims and survivors much earlier than she did.
And Durkin objected to Moon's portrayal.
That's wrong. I previously called on the mayor to do what was in the best interest of the city and to reflect deeply on that. Today, it was clear that he could not continue to serve as mayor, and it was in the best interest of the city that he resign. I called on him to resign, and I think that his decision to do so was the right decision.
So before we leave Ed Murray and talk about the mayoral race, did the Murray chapter tell us anything important about the candidates?
You know, I think Durkin definitely waited way too long to call him to resign. If it's about the health of the city, knowing what we know about how the transition is now going to occur, calling on him to resign should have happened much earlier so that candidates were aware you're going to have a very short transition period to get prepared for the city. That's using just her logic around the health of the city. But really, I haven't heard either candidate call too much attention to what's really important, which is talking about victims and survivors of abuse. At the end of the day, asking Murray to resign is not just about the health of how our bureaucracy functions. It is about what we consider justice to be, and it is about how we end up treating victims of violence and sexual assault and where power and privilege plays in that. And I haven't heard either candidate speak very effectively to what that looks like, which then leads me to wonder, when we talk about power and privilege in our city, how are they able to actually think about that pragmatically? That's the health of the city that I'm really most interested in, but that's also where I come from. It's a story that I live.
Any reaction to that?
Yeah, I haven't heard things that speak to marginalized or abused people in either statement. So I don't think either candidate would be able to distinguish themselves by saying, I'm the one who's going to, you know, be there and challenge things when the overwhelming system is against you. I didn't hear that resonate, and I haven't in those statements.
Well, let's talk about what did come up in the mayoral debate this week. Each candidate, Jenny Durkin and Carrie Moon, they were both asked about homelessness. And in one question, should the city pass a law establishing shelter as a right? So here's Carrie Moon answering that question. Should Seattleites have a legal right to shelter?
I think as a society that cares about one another, that wants to watch out for the well-being of everyone, everyone deserves the right to shelter. And we haven't done a good job with it. We sort of have this system where we provide housing as it becomes available instead of housing as a right that everyone deserves.
Candidate Jenny Durkin seemed to oppose such a law.
If I'm mayor, I won't need a law to tell me that housing is a human right and that people deserve a right for a home. And if I'm mayor, I'm going to work as hard as I can to make sure that people are brought off the street and into homes.
She didn't explicitly oppose such a law, but Carrie Moon thought about it and said, yes, that's a good idea. Durkin was more measured, you could say ambiguous, former Seattle mayor Greg Nichols. What was your reaction?
Well, I would agree that I think shelter is a right. And I think,
well, what kind of a right? A legal right? A moral right?
Certainly a moral and ethical right, and I think it should be a legal right. I think we should allow and provide adequate shelter for every human being to access.
How would that be enforced?
Well, a person could demand shelter. They could come to the door, knock on it, and say, "I demand shelter,"
and sue the city for a lack of shelter.
Well, I don't think they would necessarily be in a position to sue, but the city would then need to find them a place. And you know, this city has worked hard for many, many years to try and figure out how do we solve the homeless issue. We've built thousands of units of housing on local resources levies that have been passed since Charles Royer was mayor, twice when I was mayor. It was a very frustrating issue for me during my 8 years as mayor. It felt like we were in the middle of the ocean and we were bailing water. Every time we seemed to make some progress, something happened. The Great Recession in 2008, for instance, that put people out of homes and out of jobs and swamped our resources again. So we also need some new approaches to this. And I think one of those might be to say that you have a right to shelter and we will find that for you. That also, I think, helps us to deal with the tent issue. I think if you simply displace people who are in tents, that's troublesome. But if you have a place, you protect what few belongings they may have, then I think that, and you put them on a path to permanent housing and treatment or jobs or whatever is keeping them from being able to be successful in housing, then I think you have a more humane system that may have a better chance of success.
Attorney Nikita Oliver, should Seattle have a legal right to a shelter?
You know, I support the legal right to a shelter. I think what we have to recognize is that a legal right to shelter would really be about enforcing a value. So one of the things Carrie Moon has said, and Durkin's also said it as well, is that housing is a human right. And when we put laws like this in place, it is really because we're not seeing that human right honored. So we put it in place to create an enforcement mechanism, a way to ensure that happens.
And what would the enforcement mechanism be? How would that law work?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think it could work a lot of ways. One of them would be to say that people who choose to live in tents, and this might be the extreme, has to be treated as a shelter, and so no more sweeps. It would theoretically be a way to get rid of sweeps. The other would be the ordinance that O'Brien is putting forward about cars, providing places where people can park their cars and treat that as shelter and they cannot be forced around. Another would be, I mean, we're already using rapid rehousing, which is actually proving to be incredibly ineffective. One, we don't have enough housing units. Two, it's putting people in places where they don't want to be. They have to be put outside the city. But it also puts people in homes that they can't afford. So the next part about enforcement is, how do you ensure once you put someone in a home, which you say they have a right to, that they have a right to stay there? How is the city going to ensure that they get to be there? And so while I think the value is honored by the law, making the law work pragmatically is incredibly challenging. And what the law would do is push us to align our fiscal resources and also our strategies with the value of that law. Would it be challenging? Yes. And I think the reason Durkin sounds ambiguous on it is because she doesn't want to tick off landlords or management companies or some of her more corporate or chamber-based backers, because that would put a lot of burden on them to respond more to affordability and may even mean that we have to do things like change HALA.
You just furrowed Greg Nickel's brow. You look like your brow is furrowing listening to that.
Fortunately, it happens a lot less often these days than it did a few years ago.
Well, you're
well, it's, I mean, it is a very
Nikita,
difficult...
you have said you're voting for Carrie Moon.
Yes.
And you're...
I haven't said
you haven't endorsed anyone yet?
I have not publicly
endorsed. That's not an endorsement, by the way.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. We've talked about that. Well, do you want to publicly endorse somebody right now? Your microphone is on.
I will be voting for Jenny Durkin.
Okay. But not endorsing? Both of you are voter,
well,
voter non-endorsers.
I have offered her my endorsement. And
you offered it.
And we haven't made it public yet, and I guess I just did.
Unless KUOW, breaking news!
Unless she's going to refuse your endorsement, I think so we've just made it public. Okay.
So, I mean, it's an incredibly difficult issue, and we've been dealing with it kind of the same way for a very long time, and I think what I want to hear will be creative approaches. Because, you know, the definition of insanity is to keep doing the same thing over and over and expect different results. We're doing the same thing over and over. We're voting for levies. We're creating more housing. And yet we have more people who are homeless. So we need to figure this one out. It just is, in the 21st century, it is just wrong, ethically, morally, and it should be legally wrong for people to be homeless on the street.
One more thing on the candidate debate. They were asked about the proposal to let people live in RVs and cars without being ticketed and towed. Some neighborhood activists don't like what they've heard about a draft idea from Councilmember Mike O'Brien. And so this is Carrie Moon.
I think this got rolled out in a way that was unfair. He was putting out a test case to say, hey, this is a way to approach a solution. How can we work together and find an answer? And it got immediately attacked and vilified. But I think we need to start that conversation up again and say, how can we make this work towards a system with safe lots for folks in their RVs and cars?
Jenny Durkin was again less committal about letting people live in their vehicles with less parking enforcement.
I think the proposal so far has not been finalized. And again, I think it is not one proposal or the other. What we need to do is have a very vibrant discussion in our city about the people experiencing homelessness and focus our energies not on the fights, not on words, not on semantics, but how are we going to get them the place they deserve to live?
What did that tell us?
Punt.
A punt?
I don't know. That's what I heard.
I think it's the same thing. She doesn't have the answer. Carrie Moon doesn't have the answer. It's going to be bringing people together from different perspectives and with different expertise to figure out how do we fix this?
But I think in this regard, into this, this is a momentary mitigation of the fact that we don't have enough affordable housing. People are going to sleep in their cars regardless. So we can either make safe spaces where that can happen in a safe way and we can mitigate as much harm as possible, or it can continue to happen and we'll criminalize the act and we'll continue to criminalize poverty and our city's lack of ability to effectively provide affordable housing and address this affordable housing crisis. And while I do think we've tried and we have used the same strategies over and over, I still think what we lack is a true monetary and resource commitment to address the issue and to do just that, creative strategies that center the knowledge of the most impacted and advocates who have been working in the area of homelessness for a long time. We've created these work tables and come up with proposals, but you never see the most impacted people getting to make the decisions about what that looks like. And so I hope that actually what I see is candidates like Carrie Moon and Jenny Durkin supporting the Housing for All Coalition, which is comprised of people who have been without homes and have been really struggling within our city. And they have some incredible strategies. That's really the sort of creativity that we need. It has to come from the people that are living at the margins. And we have to be willing to put some ordinance in places that actually create safe spaces. Or like I said, we'll continue to criminalize a houselessness issue that the city's allowed to be perpetuated.
Okay, I'm going to punt this topic over to the next segment. We actually are going to talk Seahawks and football a little bit later, and politics and race. They're all coming together. But first, I'm going to punt. Actually, this is going to be a pooch kickoff. It's just going to go a few yards. We're going to recover the ball, and we're going to continue. We're going to continue the Week in Review in just a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Central Co-op and Seattle Good Business Network, presenting the Taste of Seattle Made Party, October 6th at Seattle Center, with samples from 50 Seattle producers of food and beverages, including kimchi, kombucha, pasta, and beer. Tickets at seattlemade.org.
This is KUOW 94.9 Seattle, a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington. It's 12:36. Sunny and 68 degrees in Seattle. The forecast has us reaching at least 73 this afternoon. Tomorrow's going to be sunny with highs in the 70s, and things are going to change on Sunday. We're expecting rain and a high of only 64.
Support for KUOW comes from BECU, host of the People Helping People Awards, which donates to local nonprofits nominated by members. Every debit purchase, BECU donates to the goal of $500,000 this year. Learn more about how to help at becu.org/makeadifference. Federally insured by NCUA.
You are learning from the week gone by on KUOW's Week in Review with Greg Nichols, Nikita Oliver, Phyllis Fletcher. I'm Bill Radke. I've been informed that it's an onside kick that I was referring to. I swear I heard pooch somewhere. It's like you just kind of kick it up in the air a little bit, and it rolls a little bit, and you jump on it. So we're onside kicking now. It's first down, and we've got four downs to talk about. Amazon, which is still here, by the way. The company has not left the city. They did not same-day deliver their biosphere balls to a different city, but last week, they said they want another headquarters. Governor Inslee says he's met with Amazon executives to understand the company's desire for this fully equal headquarters number two elsewhere in North America. Greg Nichols, should that announcement change anything about how local government treats Amazon?
I don't think so. When I ran in 2001 successfully for mayor, I was not supported by the business community. They were supporting my opponent.
Who was that?
Mark Sidran.
Oh, yeah.
Was his name.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. He was the city attorney at the time. But some of my first meetings were with CEOs around the city because we were entering the post-9/11 recession. And I wanted to know, what can we do to help create jobs for people who are losing their jobs at Boeing or in the tourist industry or don't have jobs? And so you have to understand what's going on with your businesses, and you need to make sure that there's a balance in how you treat different sectors of our economy. And
you wouldn't just give Amazon anything they want?
I wouldn't
tax
give them
break,
anything
subsidies,
they want. But I also wouldn't throw them out. They have created tens of thousands of jobs in our city. They're good-paying jobs, and we want those. We want Boeing to do well. We want Starbucks to do well. We want Nordstrom and Costco and Weyerhaeuser and the other great companies that are in our region to do well, because that's where a lot of people work and are able to support themselves and their families. So
that's a sign of a local. He said Nordstrom and not Nordstrom's.
Well done.
So
we want Bartell to be successful, not Bartels.
There you go. You want Dick's to do well.
Right.
You want to make sure that we're doing that.
Okay.
But Microsoft is a global company. Boeing is a global company. Amazon is a global company. Starbucks is a global company. And so I don't think you can expect or necessarily want all of those eggs in this basket.
Nikita, would you rather Amazon add 50,000 six-figure jobs in Seattle or in Toronto or Austin?
You know, given Amazon's track record with how they select who gets those jobs, I think I would want them somewhere else.
You'd rather have them grow somewhere else?
In the sense that I have seen very little attempt on Amazon's part to try to bring in local people into that business to ensure that there are pipelines for young people and young people of color to get those six-figure jobs. Instead, what we've seen is a lot of people brought to our city getting those jobs, which is causing the cost of rents to skyrocket and really making our affordability crisis that much more challenging. Now, if Amazon were to come out and say, we have this brand new program on how we're going to track young people right into Amazon and make sure that Seattleites have the right to stay in their city because we really care about Seattle and the right to stay and we want to help with the affordability crisis, I would be maybe saying something different.
So Amazon, as it is, would you be happy if they just pulled up and said, because they can be headquartered anywhere they want, if they just left, went to another city, would that be even better? Hey, Seattle shrinks a little bit. The housing prices come down. Good thing?
If Amazon just picked up and left, there'd obviously be a hole in Seattle. And so that would not be the wisest thing. I mean, I'm to the left, but okay. I'm not off the board.
Just trying to gauge where you are. Okay, you're on the board. Okay, Phyllis, you've been covering the idea of Amazon leaving, and you've been covering the, as we call it, the region of boom here.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's funny when I think about, you know, my personal time machine with Amazon and how, like, remember 20 years ago, it was like, oh my God, you know, thanks to Amazon, you can't even get a house in the CD for under $300 anymore. Like, that's a very middle class experience of how Amazon has affected middle class people. And, you know, I always think about working class people and homeless people, or people being close to being homeless, and how this has completely upended their lives. And I think that, you know, to have this discussion of like, well, what if they leave us? It's like, that would also be their decision, you know, just like the policy decisions or non-decisions they've made are also theirs. So this idea of courting and how far we should go to be keeping a company that's ultimately going to make the decision that's best for its bottom line anyway. They're going to make a decision that's best for its bottom line anyway.
But is this courting? Like, think about it. Amazon is able to put out a call for applications to what city wants them to come.
Right.
And then they're getting all these tax breaks and offers that are probably whatever city they end up in likely will displace quite a few people and also will bring a lot of new people.
Yeah.
They're actually getting to choose. There is this sort of corporate supremacy over deciding not only what city they go to, but people are vying for it. And yeah. So I think there's a level for us to start thinking about, what does this mean when corporations get so big that they can play the game in such a way that cities are going to offer them billions of dollars in tax breaks? I think that shows you really the power of corporate supremacy, even over our bureaucracy.
Right. It's attention, everyone. I am available.
Right.
That's a different kind of courting, I guess.
How about for you personally? Are you personally finding Seattle a better or worse place since Amazon moved in? We've talked a lot about policy and class and all this, but I'm just curious. We have three people here. Are you having any more fun? Is it soulless? What's your personal feeling about Seattle?
I find that I make it entails more effort to find genuine connection with people, but I'm not tagging the very popular at home delivery service with that. But uh-huh. It is something that I felt like was, you know, I was born and raised here, and I feel like there are certain gripes that people have had about Seattle for a long time that, you know, I'm like, but that's not me. And it's in recent years, it's sunk in, like, that's reality for a lot of people. It's hard to find genuine connection. And I think that with the more privatization of spaces and time, that has intensified. But it's certainly not just the fault of one hometown company. It's kind of a shift in how a lot of middle class people live their lives.
Yeah, I mean, I can't blame the big Amazon dinosaur for coming and eating everything, but it has played a part in it. And what I will say is I love Seattle, the place. I love the green. I love the rain because I'm an emo poet, and that makes me very happy.
Uh-huh. Physically, you love Seattle.
Yeah, physically, I love
Seattle. Climatically.
But my struggle is there are places that I grew to love as to why I stayed in Seattle post-college that just simply don't exist anymore. They couldn't afford the rent, or it's not the same space. You know, you go in and, you know, Tech Bros are nice for a little while, but sometimes a few beers into it, it's not the most welcoming environment for a queer
that?
Woman of color.
Have you found that?
You know, I used to go to Capitol Hill a lot as a place to not just to go out in the evening, but as a place that I knew I was going to be around other queer community. And it just simply is not the same neighborhood that it was. And it is not a safe place, especially for queer people of color. And so that does cause me that is frightening. And I personally struggle between, do I stay in Seattle, the place that I love, the land that I love, or do I leave Seattle, the environment that just does not feel like it's a place where I belong?
Mm-hmm. I love the city. I mean, I've lived here since 1961. It's changed a lot. In some ways, it's changed for the much better, and in some ways, it has changed for the worst.
What's a much better?
A much better is it's a much more diverse place than it was in 1961. It's diverse in many ways. We're being threatened now, I think, with a lack of diversity in terms of economics. We're a good place for people who are very wealthy. We're a compassionate place, I think, for people with very little. But for people in the middle, working class folks, it's a very difficult place today, and more so than it used to be. Since I left the mayor's office, transportation has gone to hell. It's just a tough place to get around. We were, you know, much better back in my day.
Yeah, you guys might as well all well just spend the night here. You made it to the U District. You brought your sleeping bags. I appreciate that.
You joke.
You try to go south on I-5, and
I'm a West Seattle person, and now that my schedule's not as full as it used to be, leaving West Seattle is a decision.
Yeah, Greg Nichols will be leaving here at 2 a.m. Yeah, just for sure.
So I think it is a great place. I think our economy is in much better shape than it was, because we used to be Boeing's town. And if Boeing, you know, caught a cold, we all got pneumonia.
Mm-hmm.
But now you have, you know, a series of sectors and companies that are forward looking and will continue to create jobs here. And I think that's healthy. Again, if you're a working class and you can't afford to live in the city, that's not good. If you are mentally ill and we don't provide good services for the mentally ill, that's not a good thing. Our transportation system, leaves a bit to be desired.
This is KUOW's Week in Review. That's Greg Nichols with Nikita Oliver and Phyllis Fletcher. Coming up, the Seahawks meets the national anthem, meets white supremacy, meets President Trump, all came crashing together. Stay tuned.
Hi, Scott Simon here. KUOW and NPR keep you informed and inspired, and your financial support makes it all possible. Now, you may have recently received an appeal in the mail. Please mail in your gift today or give online at kuow.org. Your gift now will help accelerate the upcoming fall pledge drive and get you back to regular programming sooner.
And thank you so much for your support of KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. It's 12:48, another sunny day in Seattle, 68 degrees now, on our way to an anticipated high of at least 73. Some clouds overnight, mostly sunny tomorrow, and then rainy on Sunday.
Support for KUOW comes from Strom Jewish Community Center, presenting Living Strong, an educational workshop for people with Crohn's and colitis. This day-long program is open to the public and includes a luncheon, lectures, workshops, cooking demonstrations, and more. September 17th. More at sjcc.org.
It's KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW, and we've been telling you about Seahawks lineman Michael Bennett bringing politics into sports, sitting during the anthem to call attention to racial inequity. Well, this sports and social justice debate just got kicked upstairs to the White House. ESPN anchor Jemele Hill tweeted that President Trump is a white supremacist. Trump tweeted that ESPN is paying a really big price for its politics and bad programming. People are dumping it in record numbers. Apologize for untruth! Exclamation mark. Is it true the sports world is paying a price for politics? Michael Bennett of the Seahawks is writing a book about this stuff with sports editor Dave Zirid of The Nation. Dave, thanks for dropping in.
Oh, it's great to be here, and it's great to be in this company.
Yeah, you don't live in Seattle. Why are you here today?
Washington, D.C. is where I'm from. Flew in because Michael and I are finishing up the book, page in, page out, just making sure we offend all the right people.
Excellent. In what context did Jemele Hill of ESPN call Trump a white supremacist?
I'm so glad you asked for the context, because Jemele Hill is without question the most prominent black woman in the world of sports opinionism. And she hosts the 6 p.m. Sports Center. And sports is, of course, a medium that has always privileged white male voices while celebrating black bodies.
Right.
And she represents the emerging zeitgeist in sports against that, as people like Colin Kaepernick, Megan Rapinoe, Breonna Stewart, I'm going really Seattle here, and Michael Bennett speak out, you know, against these existing power relationships and trying to change them. She's been a voice against that. Because of that, she is a magnet magnet for every racist and sexist on social media. So it's not like she was saying this in a vacuum. She was clapping back at the sheer tonnage of sewage that she gets. And she's developed quite a brand, if you will, on social media for being somebody who does push back against people. And it's interesting because ESPN is this very poorly defined social media policy where they want their personalities to express themselves and become these brands that become appointment viewing until it reaches this limit. It's like that famous quote, I forget who said it, but sometimes you don't know you're chained until you try to move. It's like, you know, she felt very free to clap back against racists and sexists, but when she took it to the White House, she found out where those chains were.
And she called the president a white supremacist. ESPN has the legal right to fire her for that, right? Or take her off the air for that act, for that tweet?
They can fire her for whatever they like. I mean, they
why shouldn't they if that's not what the corporation wants?
They shouldn't for a number of reasons. I mean, let's just talk about it just on the very basic moral level. I mean, I would argue that what she said was not untrue. I mean, she was going through the factual evidence of 40 years of public life of Donald Trump, speaking about his politics. And if one does not see that straight line of racism running all the way through, I think one is being willfully blind. So just on that level, I don't think they should fire any journalist for saying something that's rooted in fact. Like if she had said Donald Trump was born on the planet Mars to galactically transformable parents or something, like it's like yeah, fire her then. She just said something that's untrue, but she did not say anything that was untrue. That's the first reason. The second reason is that I would believe.
But a corporation has a different standard than that.
Yes,
you know.
But they would also have a full-scale revolt on their hands. Already people, I'm not even just talking about her coworkers, including black coworkers who refused to sit in her chair for her when ESPN tried to pull her the night this all broke, when Sarah Huckabee Sanders actually called for her to be fired. That's the second reason they shouldn't do it, by the way, because no corporation should bow to the pressure of government to fire somebody. It should never flow in that direction. That is an incredibly frightening precedent if that's the case. But the last reason they shouldn't is because players from Kevin Durant to Dwayne Wade, I mean, we're talking like very well-known players, have publicly come out to support Jemele Hill. So it's like, does ESPN ever want to do an interview with a black athlete again?
Yeah.
They might not want to fire Jemele Hill.
I'm going to turn this over to the panel. I got one more question for now, which is you're talking about these top elite athletes coming out in support of her. The president, just the president Trump weighing in on this makes it even more visible. Has something important changed when it comes to sports and politics? Or is this going to be an interesting story that's in our year in review segment? But, you know, but it is what it is. The sports industry is what it is.
I'll just say, like, I'm not a white supremacist. Fire that black woman is a very odd message. and didn't call for David Remnick to be fired when the New Yorker did that cover of the White Hood and whatnot. I wonder why. But is sports getting more political? I would argue there is more resistance politics in sports, but sports has always been political. The only difference is that the headwinds are not only moving in one direction.
Okay. Reaction. Right. Panel.
I would say this is really about, at the end of the day, it's about white supremacy. Go back to Sterling with the Clippers. You have audio of him.
This is the owner, the Donald Sterling, the owner of the LA Clippers.
Yeah, you have audio of him saying incredibly racist things. But even prior to that, there had been a lot of people saying this dude is racist. And it took months for him to be removed from being the owner of the Clippers. Here you have a black woman in a time where white supremacy is very clearly showing itself. And you have the president calling for her firing. It shows you that we are at a really pivotal time in history. And it's not the first time we've been at this pivotal time. I mean, we have Ali who stood up for the exact same things. We keep recycling, right? So I think this is really our opportunity to make a choice. Are we actually going to turn and face white supremacy head on? And we're going to protect folks like Hill and protect athletes who are using their platforms, leveraging it as a way to challenge white supremacy. This isn't just about Kaepernick getting a job. It's about an industry that has functioned on black bodies with white owners for a very long time. We ask ourselves whether or not we're really going to take that head on. Otherwise, in 40 years, we're going to find ourselves in exactly the same position where, you know, space football athletes are not floating for the national anthem or whatever we're doing in 40 years.
Speaking of not floating for the anthem, so Michael Bennett said that he was racially profiled and assaulted by Las Vegas police officers 3 weeks ago. A few days after that came out, the Seahawks opened their season in Green Bay, and I think only one other player sat on the bench with Michael Bennett during the anthem. Dave Zirin, why only one other player? Why did that not look very different?
I mean, I can't speak to the answer to that, but I can say that I was at the Seahawks facility yesterday with Michael, and the players there adore him. Mm. He is adored, and I'm not just talking about the players. I'm talking about the people who sweep up, the kids who bring them food during the team meetings. I mean, he could run for mayor of the Seahawks.
But they won't sit on the bench with him while he's making his...
I mean, it's one of those things where people have to make that individual choice. Players do. And I mean, it was a very... It's a dicey thing opening day for several reasons. One, they're on the road in Green Bay. Two, it's September 10th.
So they're going to get booed? Is that the idea?
It's the September 11th game. I'm just talking about the competing pressures. And three, the NFL did something very clever. One might even say devious with the first week of the season is that they dedicated all of the national anthems to the first responders who'd been working in Irma and Harvey. So
it puts out
this message to the players that, like, are you really not going to stand with the first one? And it takes somebody, I think, of incredibly strong political character, which Michael is, to say, well, wait a minute, this isn't about the messaging of the week. This is about a much broader question. And remember, Michael was sitting before the horrific nature of what happened to him in Las Vegas. But I got to say, it's not just about players standing or sitting with Michael. It's about fans as well. And that's why I'm so proud on Sunday at 11 a.m. Nikita Oliver is going to be speaking. I'm proud to say a couple of words as well.
Where?
In front of the stadium, in front of the Link, as I believe the locals call it.
You can call it the Clink. You can call it the Link. You can call it Seahawks Stadium.
12th man zone. I don't know how y'all refer to things out here. But I do know that we are going to rally in front, and it's being called by the Seattle NAACP. And I really want to invite fans who are listening to this, who are going to the game, even if you don't agree with the issues, come by and take a listen. I think there are going to be some very smart people who are going to be speaking about a side of the city that maybe we don't usually discuss.
Could this get contentious or pepper sprayish? I mean, I just want to know.
No,
this is happening on Sunday.
I mean, I will say, as someone who goes to a lot of NFL games, I mean, it makes a typical line to go through security at the airport look mellow.
I'm just saying, sometimes people, you don't know who's going to show up when they hear if there's anything politically oriented. You just don't know.
I think it's going to be safe and fine. I actually know a bunch of people who are bringing their kids who I consider to be awesome parents if they're listening, and I know they wouldn't bring their kids if they felt that way.
Okay. Any other reaction to all of this, sports and politics crashing together?
I think he's right that it's always been, sports have always been political, and that it's just when people are pushing back that a lot of times they're tagged with, quote unquote, bringing their politics into it. You see that in music, too, and all forms of entertainment. You know, people want to silence when they're anti. It doesn't mean it's been political. It doesn't mean it hasn't been political all along. Supporting status quo is still political.
I mean, it's crazy. Like, I work at a radio station in D.C. where we're not even allowed, and I'm glad about this rule, but we're not even allowed to say the name of the football team in Washington, D.C.
Oh, right.
So, politics are part of sports no matter what.
But it's really about who's pushing back. You know, I remember seeing an article, I forget which player, a white player who was joining in solidarity with black players, and his wife ended up writing a response saying, don't give him any honor or applause for doing the right thing, because people were like, look at this white player, like, standing with black people. And that's how it always goes. I mean, we could take this full circle back to the beginning of our weekend review. No one cared about, I mean, I'm sure they cared. Yes, they cared. But there wasn't real push for Murray to resign until a white person more aggressively put their allegations out there. Even in instance like this one, white people get privileged and get the privilege of choosing to be a part of movements that are necessary. This is not new. White supremacy is not new. Politics and athletics being intertwined is not new. And yet When black and brown folks are the ones to call it out, we get chastised, we lose our jobs, or we're threatened because it's a dicey situation. White people choose to do it, and it's like, wow, you're so progressive. And that is very much the Seattle way.
So KOW has invited Seattle Seahawks defensive lineman Michael Bennett onto the program. He hasn't made that happen yet. We're trying to reach out to someone who's writing a book with him called Page In, Page Out, like the sports editor for The Nation. Dave Zirin, can you hook us up? You can come on together.
I think that would be no problem whatsoever.
Okay.
I'm sure Michael would come on, whether it's in season or after the season, certainly when the book is out. I mean, one thing I can tell you about Michael is that he loves this city. And if you love the city, you got to love KUOW.
Hey, how about that?
All right.
Dave Zirin and former mayor of the city, Greg Nichols. We've got 30 seconds.
I just wanted to, one of the things that I am most proud of during my time as mayor was something we started called the Race and Social Justice Initiative. It's still going a dozen years later. And it's simply an attempt to have a conversation about all of these issues and understand what is institutional racism, what is white privilege, and have a conversation that's honest and maybe takes us.
Thank you for the conversation. Mm-hmm. Phyllis Fletcher, Nikita Oliver, Greg Nichols, Dave Zirin, thank you all. Rally on Sunday at the Clink.
Yep.
Thank you.